we haven't done this in a while. We've had, since our last episode, amazing feedback. So I'm excited to do this again, Maxim. And again, we haven't spoken in a while. So I'm just very keen to check in with you, how you've been doing and what's been going on with you and just in general in our lives around Ukraine and our feelings about the whole situation.
Yeah, I promise I'm not deflecting, but I really actually want to stay a bit on the topic of our previous episode. Well, first of all, we're already midway through our third season, and the last episode was on Russian language in Ukraine. Gathered so much feedback even after the show, and keeps gathering. We release it as a public podcast as well, and I think it's strikes a chord with so many, because as you remember, when we were picking the topic and focus for our season three, we had with you two of us, we had a bit of a concern whether the word decolonization would kind of be too complex or maybe too unappealing for a larger audience. But we decided to go with it anyway, because I feel, and now I see with the feedback of people, that is actually something that can connect people, even those who do not know or do not maybe even care as much about Ukraine, because taking back control over who you are is such a powerful topic, and so many people can share their tips and their insights. And as we've seen with the last episode, that exactly what has happened, because so many people reached out and said, like, well, I'm going through a similar journey and with a language, although it's not Ukrainian or Russian, and I feel you and I understand. And that was very powerful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And even like thinking back to our conversation myself, I've just been like kind of thinking more and more about it. And I also think like we've done so much. You know, first two seasons, we've been doing so much for kind of audiences that are keen to learn more about Ukraine, that might not necessarily know a lot already about Ukraine. But it's actually been really rewarding to see that this season has really like been important for Ukrainians as well, which I think is super powerful and important for us as well. And that a lot of people have been able to see their own stories through some of the discussions that we've been having, whether that was language or anything else. So I'm excited for today as well. And I'm keen to hear what our guest this episode also has to say. And as Maxim and I always say, I think we can jump right into our interview and start talking to Olga. But we always have one golden rule, because we also just think it's super important for everyone to feel as comfortable as they are with introducing themselves. So we would just like, Olga, if you could please introduce yourself to our audience and tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you do.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today. And I hope that what I have to say and share will be interesting and hopefully also provocative. I'm Dr. Olga Onuch. I am a political scientist at the University of Manchester. I am Ukrainian. I have a very complicated life history that won't go into this very short interview, maybe, or maybe will. But I study political behavior, civic identity, and civic activism in Ukraine, and I've been doing so for 18 years now.
You've been through the years such a huge inspiration, and I'm a huge fan of your work, and we've been wanted to have you on the show for a while, but also for a simple reason, because, you know, as a journalist, as a storyteller, as a Ukrainian, we, especially in the last year since the genocide started, we talked a lot about our feelings, our ideas, our thoughts, our worldviews. But what is often lacking is hardcore research and data and this, kind of a more fact-based approach that can back us. And back our claims. And this is exactly what you've been constantly through years coming through and delivering over and over again. So thank you so much. Sorry for taking a bit of time again for fangirling, but just wanted to share with everyone why I'm such a huge fan of your work. But I think, you know, we always want to focus first on our Ukrainians and to offer them opportunity to tell their stories as well. And the question we with Valeria really wanted to ask you at first is, can you maybe share what is comfortable for you to share, how personally you ended up doing the work you're doing? Because I suspect that a lot of your background, your Ukrainian background, kind of pushed you and informed you in the direction of the work that you're doing today.
And Maxim and Valeria, I can fangirl out about you guys as well. This can go on forever. But a huge fan of you guys and all the work you've done, and obviously the podcast. But the question is difficult. And I always say, the first thing I say, and at least those who know me very well know that my accent always betrays me. Being the third language I learned in my life, Ukrainian being the first, Polish being the second. And those are languages that I spoke for the first quarter of my life, right? And that alone, 18 years in the United Kingdom, I have not developed a British accent. I do not have a case of the Madonnas when she was dating Guy Ritchie, or married to Guy Ritchie, sorry. But so that's one thing I think when people also speak to Ukrainians abroad, they sometimes are surprised, you know, you've heard this, I'm sure. Oh, how well you speak in English. I don't always get that because people just assume that I come from somewhere in North America, let's say. But how did I come to research the things I research? Well, my story just of language right there is one such example. I have one identity above all, and that is being Ukrainian. I am ethnically Ukrainian. I'm a citizen of several different countries. I'm a resident, or I have a permanent residency in Ukraine, but I'm not a citizen. This is a very important thing, this my central Ukrainianness and my central identity. And that's how I was raised. That's how life was explained to me. Both my parents are Ukrainians. And I was born in Poland, still under communism. And when I was born in Poland, you had to choose even the names off of a list of Communist Party approved names. And the spelling of my name had to be with a G and could not be with an H, no matter how much my father or mother wanted to. Name me Olha and not Olga. And it was moments like this that really just ingrained in me who I am, and that's who I was. And I really felt always like I didn't have a choice about it. When I was born, my father was, I guess, reclaiming his Ukrainian language at the time. And he's a contemporary artist, this weird kind of contemporary art, performance art. And one of his early performances during my life was to paint me in gold dust and put me in a bread basket. You know, Ukraine is the bread basket of Europe, him finding his Ukrainian identity. And as a baby, I had this little entry into the art world. But yeah, this is how my life was like. And then my parents lived in Ukraine for a very long period of my life. And I only had this identity. And this is why I study it. This is why it intrigues me. What drives individual identities? How do people come to understand their identities? When are civic versus ethnic identities or linguistic identities more important? When do they become activated? Through my own life experiences, I knew that that was so much more complex than what people were at least openly talking about in political science about Ukraine. I felt it necessary to continue that research. The other thing I should note, my parents have a little bit of an activist history. I won't tell all the details and secrets today, but needless to say, Bibua, which is informal activist propaganda pamphlets and so on, was actually deposited at my parents' apartment and picked up at my parents' apartment for Solidarność. So that's the other reason why I study protest and activism.
Oh, before we actually go to that fantastic book that absolutely everybody should have, and it's, you know, the release is such a perfect timing. It's called The Zelensky Effect. I really wanted to have really quick follow-up on what you said, because You know, we've had so many Ukrainians coming to the show, whether those who were born in Ukraine and those who were born abroad. And one thing that you mentioned is about how, you know, when you're in a hostile environment, and for Ukrainians always is, whether back at home or abroad, you kind of have to juggle their multiple identities. You know, you need to fit, you know, some colonial tropes, or you need to fit some foreign societies when it comes to your identity. Was it also something that influenced you and your passion for studying identities? And was it also hard for you to kind of juggle and to fit, you know, all these expectations, what a Ukrainian should be, look like, and talk, speak like, and whatnot?
Absolutely, Maxim. I mean, I think that is the story of all of us, right? What does it mean to be Ukrainian? What does it mean to be a certain type of accepted Ukrainian in the particular community or society that you are in? And that is, yes, of course, that is underpins my research. I should say there's a reason why I work with non-Ukrainians on Ukrainian identity and civic engagement and other things, because it helps me with my own identity, not crossing always into my research as much as it informs my research, right? So sometimes I do need the non-Ukrainian colleague to really help me work through some things that are also obviously affecting me. But absolutely, certainly, at some point I moved to Canada, hence my accent. And the Ukrainian diaspora community, which I had no concept of as a child or as a teen later, it was very foreign to me, right? And that version of Ukrainianness was foreign to me. And I had to adapt to that because there was a certain correct way of being Ukrainian in the Toronto Plast Ukrainian Scouts diaspora setting. And then, of course, early in my childhood, my father moves to Kyiv and I'm spending my summers in Kyiv. And there I'm adjusting to other versions of Ukrainianness and expectations. My family comes from Lviv, and my Teta and Vuiko have a certain way of being. My family has a certain way of being. Family, friends, certain understandings. And then, of course, over your teen years, you develop your own friendships and into your 20s and so far. And those people have different expectations of Ukrainianness, right? And I have to say, it wasn't until my 20s that I developed close friendships with Russian-speaking Ukrainians. And my comfort with both languages also changed at that point, I think, in my life. And then I started to have these incredible personal relationships that were bilingual, where I always spoke Ukrainian, my friends always spoke Russian, and we had a common understanding no matter what. And a common understanding of what it means to be Ukrainian in that moment as well. And I think that moment in my life, which was very personal, really shaped the way I started to study this stuff professionally, obviously. And I think it also helped me fight some of my familial biases or biases that were bestowed upon me when I was living in Canada. And that was very helpful. And I mean, Alustina Kahidze is one of these friends. And, you know, sometimes she switches into Russian when we speak, sometimes she speaks Ukrainian. And that was one of the most beautiful, I think, friendships that has developed over years. And also an understanding of the different ways we talk about who we are and what it means to us.
Thank you so much. You know, when I think it's just so amazing, like the more people that we speak to on our podcast, I hope the more people realize how diverse the experiences of Ukrainians are, because I think what you were talking about, your personal story and, you know, moving from one country to another and experiencing your identity in one way is so different to the experience that, you know, I had, for example, personally myself. And it's just so amazing to really see what you are talking about, which is this like common understanding still of what it means to be Ukrainian. And when we were preparing for this episode, Maxim and I were discussing how I actually didn't even, and you know, I in university and after university for my master's studied like international relations, politics and all of that. But the term like civic nationalism, I never really, you know, paid attention to it as much. And I was interested in like other things within that whole area of studies. And it was only until for me personally this year that I really that those two words became so important for me in the way that I spoke about Ukraine and explained Ukraine to a lot of people. It became kind of the easiest way to explain why Ukrainians are behaving in the way that we were behaving when Russia invaded and things like that. And you know, obviously your book is about your recent book, The Zelensky Effect, is a lot about how Zelensky embodies kind of that term, but also that feeling that a lot of Ukrainians have. And I'm sure many people have asked you this on many occasions, but I just was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more. Mostly our audience is people who are not Ukrainian. Why you think this kind of term and this I don't even know how to describe it, but why is civic nationalism so important in explaining Ukraine to people?
Well, because that's what it is. That's the dominant identification for most Ukrainians, and it has been for years. And we maybe weren't using that terminology, certainly not in public discourses, but that's what was happening. And you know, obviously scholars have written about this before, but that's what was happening. And as, you know, as a scholar myself, it was just important to keep highlighting it. And, you know, I can work by Volodymyr Kulik and others that came before me. They stressed this civic identity of Ukrainians and state attachment. And what we do in the book with Henry, we make sure to show that this is not, first of all, this is not a 2022 phenomenon. This is not simply Zelensky period phenomenon. This is not a post-Euromaidan phenomenon, post-Orange Revolution. This has been around certainly since Ukrainian independence and even predates it, right? So those who were writing about Ukrainian, the obviously different types of nationalism, we don't need to pretend that that wasn't the case, but there is a history about writing about civic state-centered and not ethno-linguistic nationalism in Ukraine. And my favorite example that people forget about, and we write about in the book, and we did so only because, well, not only because I love this dissident, but primarily because Zelensky spoke about this individual in one of his speeches, Ivan Dzyuba. Ivan Dzyuba is a dissident, right, during the Soviet period. He is from Donetsk Oblast. He is a Russian speaker all his life and teaches himself Ukrainian in his 20s. He's a dissident and an activist, but he's also a true believer in communism. He writes this amazing treaties, diatribe, you can name it various ways, against Russian imperialism. And he was very worried about Russian imperialism in Ukraine and the Russification of Ukraine as a civic entity. He was so convinced of this that the true communism will accept this aspect of Ukrainianness and reject the Russification of it, that he delivered this to the Communist Party himself. And that is one Ivan Dzyuba, but that is the history of millions of Ukrainians just like him, who in different ways kept repeating this identity, this story. In 1991, when Ukraine becomes independent, not only obviously we know that the majority of every single oblast voted very much in favor of independence, what happens in that first decade? People in Kharkiv, Kyiv, Odessa, Sevastopol, Donetsk, Luhansk, I mean, I can keep Dnipro, you can keep naming names, move more and more to identifying themselves as Ukrainian. And when we start measuring and tracing this, this happens most in Russian-speaking areas of the country. And when we start researching this more, we find that they are saying they belong to the Ukrainian state nation. They might be Ukrainian, Russian, sorry, speakers. They might be ethnically Russian, but they belong to the Ukrainian state nation. And so this is very much a grassroots up, bottom up phenomenon in Ukraine. In fact, politicians kept trying to create dividing lines between the Easterners and the Westerners and the Ukrainian speakers and the Russian speakers. But anyone who actually lived in Ukraine knew that this wasn't how it operated. No one would get into a fight with you in Kyiv or Kharkiv if you spoke Ukrainian. And in my favorite memory is when I was in Donetsk and people were apologizing to me for not speaking in Ukrainian enough. And I didn't have a problem with it at all. But we just had a lovely, really, it was just a lovely situation at a Shakhtar game, actually. But that's the story of Ukraine. That's the story of ordinary Ukrainians. That's the story of civic nationalism. Attachment to Ukraine's statehood, above everything, and attachment to Ukrainian state democracy, Ukrainian democracy, which is a combination for, I think, most Ukrainians. The state exists in a democratic Ukraine. So if you are attached to the state of Ukraine and you want it to continue to exist, you are also attached to its democracy and the deepening of that democracy.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for also making it super clear and easy to understand within the book, because one of the most popular myths that, well, there was like Ukraine before genocide and then the genocide started, Zelensky came and suddenly everything has changed. When in fact, when you dig deeper and you showcase with your previous research as well, you look at the Maidan Revolution, you look at the Orange Revolution, you look at the 1991 Revolutsiya na Graniti, when Ukrainians helped to make the independence, the formal independence possible, you see all those snapshots of the same pattern, of the same behavior that people, Ukrainians, opted out in the times of crisis, choosing the state, choosing the community, choosing each other as fellow citizens and, standing up for each other. And thank you also for bringing focus on Eastern regions, because when I personally started researching and educating myself about what was happening in late 1980s, early 1990s, I was shocked to find out so much patriotic activism in the Russian-speaking regions of Ukraine, with environmental activism, with political activism, people speaking Russian but demanding Ukrainian independence. And this is something that many foreigners also do not know, and it's probably the reason why they don't understand what Ukrainian nationalism actually means. You're pointing out that Ukrainians have been rallying for this narrative to be united and independent in an inclusive way for now over 20 years, but probably it extends much further than that. So do you think that Zelensky is, actually the product of this desire for Ukrainians to decolonize themselves? If yes, then why do you think that the idea of civic nationalism that Ukrainians subscribe to is actually helping us to decolonize better, to take back control over our own narrative at the moment?
It's a really interesting question. So first, I think it's important to be very open about the fact that there are competing visions of Ukrainian nationalism. And there have been for the last 30 years, if not longer. And some are compatible, some are not compatible. what I do as a social scientist, I don't talk about normative things, what should be, right? I maybe do that in private conversations. But as a social scientist, I look at what is. So I can say that the dominant Ukrainian nationalism is civic state attachment, right? And if that already is the dominant type of Ukrainian nationalism, then I think it's important not only to admit it to it for those who maybe do not quite fully agree with it, but also to help it flourish, because it has been the reason why, you know, southeastern Ukraine has been not only tragically the battleground of Russian aggression, but also the best show of Ukrainian civic force. It is this civic attachment, no matter what language you speak, no matter what ethnicity you belong to, what religious practice you may have, that accepted this more cosmopolitan aspect of Ukraine, that is the reason why Ukraine is standing today. I firmly believe that. That is a personal view, but I firmly believe that. What I think happens, clearly, Zelensky is a product of this. This civic nation makes Zelensky who he is today, right? He comes out of this civic nation. He was steeped in it all his life. And what happens, though, when he does become president, is that he not only embodies it, but he continues to vocalize and communicate it repeatedly. So we did a really detailed content analysis of all his speeches, but also of all the entertainment aspects. So we did content analysis and discourse analysis of the Servant of the People show, of the skits, of the theatrical performances. I did that all because I actually started doing all of that work in 2019 when Natalia Gomenyuk says, Olya, you have to rewatch all of this again. You have to rewatch all of this again and listen for the things that you may have missed before. And indeed, that notion of civic unity, civic identity, state attachment, regardless of what language you speak, was present throughout. And it's present in his messaging. And then he links it very cleverly to democratic duty and the duty to engage in politics in his speeches. He also very cleverly linked it to Euro-Atlanticist policy positions, repeatedly linking this united civic identity to a Euro-Atlanticist position, to a liberal democratic position. And so what we found in our analyses is that people who voted for Zelensky or his party, who did not hold these positions before, weren't quote-unquote Democrats, or didn't have a strong sense of civic duty, or didn't believe in Euro-Atlanticist positions for Ukraine, over his presidency came to those positions. So his discourses brought these individuals to, and I think, again, stressing that these are the people literally stopping the tanks with their hands as the tanks are rolling in. And that is incredible. And it's just, it is what it is. People have different visions of what Ukrainian nationalism should be, could be. Decolonization is a complex and long process, and it certainly will not be over simply even with the end of the war. But I think people need to understand that although it's a point of discussion, it should be debated in a democracy. That's the only healthy way to do. But certainly you do not want to create divisive discourses, and certainly not at a time of all-out war. That which unites Ukrainians is stronger than that which divides them, and it must continue to be so.
Thank you so much. You know, it's I always am so fascinated by the way that the language that those in power use actually has an effect on the way that a country and an identity and a people develop their understanding of themselves. And I think it's just, yeah, so fascinating how Zelensky has been doing it differently, perhaps, to those before. And thank you so much for taking us through this. I also wanted to ask you, I think just to explain this a little bit better to people who outside of Ukraine, I was wondering if in, you know, in your research or in some of the work that you've been doing, there's any parallels with other countries where this sense of civic nationalism is as strong as it is in Ukraine, so that we can perhaps explain to people a little bit better, drawing on some parallels with others as well.
That's a great question. I mean, I can't speak about countries that I don't research. And that's the tricky part. In Eastern Europe, I would be hard-pressed to find countries where a civic identity is dominant for a variety of reasons. You know, Poland would not be the greatest example because so much of Polish identity is also connected to ethnic Polish identity, right? And to the Catholic religion. And that is something that is repeatedly accepted by across the political spectrum. You know, it's sometimes controversially. So I think the best example of a civic country would be Canada itself. It is a country where there is a minority that speaks French. I went to a French school when I lived in Canada, or a French program when I lived in Canada, French immersion. And that is actually a geographical divide in the country. And there has been, obviously, a history of Quebecois independence movements. But predominantly, there is a sense of unity across the country. People learn both languages everywhere. And primarily, people identify with the Canadian state, right? This is obviously a newer democracy, in a sense. It is a former colony. It's a slightly different history from those countries in Europe. But certainly, it's this idea where you can be whoever you are, and that is very important to keep maintaining your identity of descent, but nonetheless be an active contributor to the civic society. In Europe, it gets complicated. I think there people have different views on how far civic identity can take you in many countries. So, you know, there is a notion of civic identity in France, but it perhaps is actually tied very much to a particular French identity. There is a notion of civic identity in the United Kingdom, but obviously there are long histories that between the different countries that make up the United Kingdom that I think to say I think most diplomatically are incredibly complex, and there is disagreement about the civicness of United Kingdom identity and how well it incorporates other groups, right? And that's an ongoing discussion in British politics. Ukraine is, I think, pretty impressive in the region for that reason. Maybe Argentina, maybe some Latin American countries where there's also a similar notion. But again, these are different historical developments to how these countries came about. And therefore, they aren't necessarily comparable with Ukraine. But certainly a notion of civic unity or civic collective nation is present in many former colonies. And that may be an interesting point to end.
That's a great point to highlight as well. And I really appreciate you actually bring back conversation to the times before genocide started, because Zelensky hasn't become this national leader just overnight, and his landslide victory in 2019 elections, as you rightly point out, was carried by this carefully crafted messaging emphasizing unity, a renewed sense of inclusive national identity, shared civic responsibility. So regardless of ethnicity, skin color, sexual identity, language, you can be and you should be a Ukrainian and, you know, do your part for the country. But you also rightly pointed out that always there's on every issue in Ukraine, there is a debate. And much more so on the in the terms of nationalism. There are different people subscribing to different nationalisms, even within Ukraine. And there is, of course, Russian propaganda that exploits this issue and tries to emphasize one type of nationalism and, over the other. So as a researcher, as a scholar, as a person who spent decades on this issue, do you have maybe some helpful tip for other people? What kind of facts you came across, or what kind of observations you usually use to confront people who present, let's say, you know, marginal, misleading ideas about Ukrainian nationalism, plainly speaking, calling Ukraine a Nazi state where everyone's like a hardcore fascist or something nonsense like that?
Well, I mean, Maxima, there's facts. And I think when somebody presents you, the first time they present you with a version of reality where they talk about the overwhelming number of Nazi or radical right-wing movements or radical right nationalism in Ukraine, and you very quickly present them with the facts, whether that it's from surveys, whether that's from pop culture, whether that is from the general long history of Ukraine. And, you know, you can come up with examples constantly. You can bring up everyone from, I don't know, Jamala, Mustafa Nayem, Ivan Zyuba, people with the diverse histories and belongings throughout Ukrainian political, cultural history. If they repeat that information again, then they're just not willing to accept facts, right? Ukrainians don't vote for radical right-wing parties in any substantial way. Of course, there are right-wing nationalists, radical right-wing nationalists in Ukraine, as there are in every other democracy. These are, in Ukraine, in the last several elections, these parties have received, if any, very, very small, 1-2% of the vote. And in other countries, they actually receive quite a great deal more. If people don't respond to these facts, then it's clear that they don't want to know a fact. And that's really troubling, because people are deciding to believe a version of truth and reality that is not real, right? And then you have to start understanding why that person believes that. It's always has been shocking, and not least because I've underscored that, you know, I said in a radio interview in Kyiv in 2019 before the elections that Russian speakers are also patriots, and I was actually criticized by some people who do not believe that it is patriotic to speak Russian. That happened. Okay, people have different views. But when it's a person like me who goes out and tells people the thing that you think about radical nationalism in Ukraine isn't true, and I can talk about the nuances and they still don't want to believe it, then there's really nothing you can do. But what I do, Maxime, is do exactly the story of Ivan Zyuba is, I think, a perfect example of, if you didn't know any better, you would think that Ivan Zyuba was a Ukrainian nationalist, and he wasn't. You know, if you didn't know any better, you're not Ukrainian and you don't understand that one of the so-called grandfathers of the Euromaidan was a person who immigrated to Ukraine when they were younger, then that story, those stories are important, and they help, I think, communicate the reality of Ukraine, and also personal histories. I think when people speak to, when my friends visited me in Kyiv and they realized that I'm having a constant multilingual conversation and that everything is so nice and pleasant, they were surprised because that challenged their biases, right? And so personal experience helps. But yeah, you can, a few facts here and there. I think life stories, personal stories, the kind of work that you guys do on the podcast helps. But if someone's not willing to listen, then there's very little you can do about it. Just spoke to colleagues in Brazil, and I find it really important when communicating, especially with my colleagues in Argentina and Brazil, countries I also do research on, to really convey the fact that some of that version of Ukrainian nationalism is, of course, correct historically, and there is this element, but the way that it's presented as being anywhere near dominant to Ukrainian identity and reality is presented through the lens of an imperial colonial power that has repeatedly oppressed Ukraine and its other neighbors. It is and has been, hopefully will not be, the regional hegemon. And when you speak in those terms, I think, to my friends and colleagues in Latin America, they have a different, perhaps, regional hegemon, and they have a different idea of who colonial powers are. When we are able to convey it in that language, they are able better to understand that their version of truth that they received is actually that of the hegemon and not of the people living in the country itself.
Yeah, you know, actually, both Maxim has a question for you and I have a comment. And all of these three things connected with what you just said kind of point to the same exact essence of what we are talking about, which is that I think a lot of the issues that we've been having with kind of how people have been looking at Ukraine and understanding Ukraine is that people have been looking at Ukraine through their own biases, through their, which is natural, right? Like, we're all human beings who have our own set of kind of how we see the world because of where we grew up and what we know. And I was just going to say that in terms of nationalism, like, I think the problem with the way that a lot of people report on Ukraine or talk about Ukraine or analyze Ukraine who aren't Ukrainians is that they look at Ukraine and Ukrainian nationalism, I guess, through the lens of the nationalism that is prevalent within their society. So as you said, you know, like ethnic nationalism or whatever it is. And it's just so important to have resources like the book that you wrote and just in general, more conversations about the fact that actually sometimes these terms that we think we know so well, like, for example, nationalism, can actually be different in different contexts for different people in different historical contexts and regional contexts. And as you said as well, like, it's so important to really understand and explain with the language that people know why there are similarities between how we feel and what we fight for. So that's just been, yeah, super amazing to hear again. And I think the other thing that you also touched upon, which is that, like, personal stories are so, personal histories, personal stories have been so, so important in our fight kind of against oppressive hegemon of Russia. I think that's just so important again. And we've spoken about this as well, but that is why Russia has been so actively trying to erase our personal histories as well. You know, our stories are so powerful that they have been kind of our tool for fighting back, but they have also experienced a lot of that kind of oppressive policies and whatnot that Russia has been kind of imposing on us. And even now, you know, we see them, I don't know, destroying our archives, destroying our cities, destroying our stories in a way that we've not seen before. So thank you so much for that. And I'll pass back to Maxim.
I mean, I have nothing to add. That's exactly where my thoughts. And thank you so much for pointing to the fact that the erasure of indigenous voices is something that Russia has been exceptionally good at. In my own village where I come from, the first thing they did when the occupation started, they actually raided the archive and they destroyed all the Ukrainian language books and they burned the documents. So and it hasn't been the first time they did this to that village, and it was the same in the beginning of 20th century. And they, even when they raided some our houses, they destroyed even our family albums, so people do not have even pictures. And that was exactly the precise goal, is to make sure that people are badly equipped to tell their own stories generations to come. And that's why it's so important for us to keep amplifying those personal experiences and personal stories, what we're actually doing here at Ukrainian Spaces. Olu, we have to wrap up, and we want to leave this episode with our favorite question to you. And I think in many ways you answer it through this episode, but what it means for you to be Ukrainian these days, and has it evolved or changed in any way in the, since the genocide started?
Maxima, I knew you were going to ask that question, and as soon as you asked it, I have to say I got extremely emotional and I have tears in my eyes. So that's the first thing. It means everything to me, I think, and it means everything to every single Ukrainian right now. And it is us doing what we can. If you are part of the 44 million army or the 66 million army or whatever around the world, you do your job. You do it to the best of your ability. I do it with non-Ukrainians so that they help me along the way and support me, but also to make sure that I maintain my academic purpose and clarity and follow the empirics at all times. And I think that's what it means to be Ukrainian today, to living up to your personal civic duty and paying that forward, even though we're going through a very difficult time, that our family and friends are going through a horrific time, that other people who we have maybe never met are going through the worst time of their life. But I want to say, you just said something about generations and wiping out the history, and so that individuals won't be able to tell their own story or to make it difficult. You can't do that. No matter how hard you try, you cannot wipe away the experiences of people. And oral histories have been around with us for millennia, and Ukrainians have been doing it also for thousands of years. But my dido, Yaroslav Verbovey, who was himself a displaced person, whose family was forcibly displaced, and they were given just a mere hour or so to pack up their life and be forcibly moved to a different part of the country. He remembers every single thing about his house, about the trees, about the brook, about the community. And he told that story to us repeatedly all his life. And now I can tell the story of his village, of his house, of the trees, of the brook, of what fish were there. And by the way, the memory of every single poem that he was taught in as a very young child in his Ukrainian school. And you cannot change that. You cannot take that away. We will pass it on, and we are here.
Olga, thank you so much. I just got the biggest goosebumps I've had yet during our episodes, because my grandmother remembers every single poem, well, remembered every single poem from when she was 5 years old, and she was able to recite them when she was 85. She had dementia, so by that point, you know, there's a lot she did not remember, but she remembered so many details about her village that she grew up in, you know, the smell of mint in the pre-revolutionary city, and she remembered just so much. And it's just so beautiful to know that it's something that a lot of Ukrainians, this, as you said, this personal history, this memory that people have carried through with them. And I'm so grateful that we were able to remember that as well and carry it with us as well as we go into doing different things in life, whether that is, you know, studying civic nationalism or doing any other things. And it's just so amazing to see that we share those stories as well with each other. So thank you so, so much for being with us here today. We're super grateful, and this was an amazing episode. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for so plainly and easy to break down such a complex topic of nationalism. And I think that in general, when we talk about decolonization, taking back control of our own narrative or our stories, it could be a very frightening experience, because at some point you realize that entire chunks of your identity were forced upon you. And now you're left with this, you know, sometimes gaping hole of not understanding who you really are. And this is where this idea of civic identity comes through, civic patriotism, civic nationalism, because you feel that you're not alone on this journey and you can help each other. And it gets easier because of that, because you know that definitely there's someone out there like yourself going through the same. And this, in the essence, is what I think being Ukrainian nationalist for me is, to a feeling of this community behind you, that you do it not for yourself, not for someone else, but you do it with each other together. So thank you, Olya, once again. Thank you so much for everyone who joined our live show on the Twitter Spaces, but most importantly, also those who are listening this as a podcast. And want to just to let you know that you can check all our older episodes by going to ukrainianspaces.com. We're remastering our first season, and there's so much cool stuff there that is super relevant despite being recorded almost over a year ago. And also big thanks to our Patreon sponsors. The show is 100% sponsored and funded by you. Without you, it wouldn't be happening. And last thanks to our small team, to Valeria, to you, but also to Tatiana and Solomia. Thank you for making sure that this show is top-notch, as good as it could be. That's all, apart from our final traditional thing, is Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава.
Bye.
See you next time.